You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, after yesterday's shooting down of a Russian fighter by Turkey, the recriminations, strategic posturing and diplomatic theatrics get properly into gear. My guests John Everard and Isabel Hilton will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Brussels emerges from lockdown. However serious the threat, isn't a response like this in itself a victory for terrorism? We'll also look at Tunisia, where Islamic State has claimed responsibility for yesterday's suicide bombing of a military bus. Was it another part of a coordinated campaign or a symptom of a syndrome operating under its own momentum? And as Maurizio Macri prepares to move from City Hall to the Casa Rosada, we'll ask if running a city is good practice for running a country. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. We are going to start tonight with yesterday's shooting down of a Russian Su-24 by F-16s belonging to the Turkish Air Force. Today, the surviving Russian airman, the plane's navigator, Captain Konstantin Murakhtin, who was recovered, intriguingly, by a combined mission of Syrian Special Forces and Hezbollah, refuted Turkish suggestions that his aircraft had either violated Turkish airspace or been warned that it was so doing. Isabel, with all due recognition that we may never, ever, ever know the truth of what actually happened, Turkey still seems to be claiming at once two things which at least don't make sense to me. One, that the jet was warned 10 times, and the other, that the jet was over Turkish airspace for 17 seconds. I don't know how many times you can shout bugger off in 17 seconds or the Turkish equivalent of
Probably not 10 times.
I don't know.
Yep.
I haven't tried.
Me neither. My Turkish is a little rusty, but the Russians say they weren't warned. I mean, who can you believe in this? There have been repeated violations of Turkish airspace
this
by the Russians. This we know. There's been a lot of unhappiness about it, and indeed there seemed to be some conciliatory moves earlier by the Russians. They went to talk about this and promised to be good. You know, 17 seconds in a very fast-moving jet, it's not a lot of time. I think they were a little quick on the button, honestly, in Turkey. And there have been some casualties beyond the pilot. You know, there have been casualties in terms of the political processes which were at least being kind of marshalled to address this situation in a more grown-up way.
Which, of course, was largely the Turkish objective. Turkey really did not want to see this cuddling up between Russia and the West for reasons that we could spend a long time discussing. Were they warned? The Turks have not claimed that they warned them during the 17 seconds. They saw this aircraft, they saw two aircraft heading quite clearly towards Turkish airspace and warned them repeatedly, 10 times they say, as they approached it. They refused to turn change course, and it was over Turkish airspace, say the Turks, that they fired.
We do not know, at least as yet, at what level this decision was taking, whether this all went all the way to the big desk or whether this was a possibly somewhat over-enthusiastic local commander whose president and country is now obliged to defend him. But, John, first of all, even if we take Turkey's word for it, and, you know, when we're trying to decide whether to take Erdogan or Putin's word for something, it's, you know, flip a coin, really. Even if Turkey is right, though, isn't this something of an overreaction?
No. I think Turkey was absolutely right to do what it did. I think that Turkey has been provoked for many, many months now with Russian incursions into its airspace. This incursion, as the Turks say, if you are heading towards airspace, you're warned 10 times and you keep going, that is a premeditated incursion. It's a gross violation of international law, and the Turks have given the Russians warning after warning after warning. Interestingly, you don't have to take just the Turks' word for the fact that the aircraft were warned 10 times. The United States has now come come out and said that it's listened to the transcripts and, yes, it's heard all the warnings.
So next time a Turkish aircraft incurs on Greek airspace, which they do not infrequently for one reason or another, the Greeks would be well within their rights to take a shot at it?
The Greeks would be well within their rights to warn Turkey formally that if it does it again, that it's going to get shot at which point Turkey, not being quite as insane as other countries I might mention, would probably not do it again.
Isabel, we have talked about this, I know, on this program at various points, certainly when it became clear that Russia was going to launch a major air campaign in Syria at a time when the various air forces from various other countries are also waging major air campaigns in Syria, that you didn't need to be too bright to predict that something very like this was bound to happen sooner or later. Is it being absurdly optimistic of me to assume that surely at some level, hopefully a very high level, discussions have been had about the protocols to observe in such an unfortunate event?
I think that is quite optimistic,
I
honestly.
I do my best. But
on the other hand, I think that the Russian reaction has been relatively moderate. You know, there's been a lot of shouting so far. We don't seem to have seen anything more than that. So I suspect we disagree about this, but I think that in moral high ground terms, Russia is pretty much on it, which is a good place for Russia to be. Now, just going back to the question of the 17-second incursion, you know, some of that wreckage fell in Syria. The pilots seem to have landed. So what was the trajectory of the plane? You know, if it was over the border, it wasn't over the border in a, you know, flying into Turkey. It was pretty much, you know, on the border or perhaps just over the line. You know, that's not a hostile incursion, in my view. It can happen, you know, regardless of your intention, because, you know, borders, when you're in the air, you know, it's sometimes not that clear. And clearly it was very close. So if we were looking to be, you know, at least reasonable about who we believe here, I think that you could take the view that the Turks were pretty trigger happy. And if they did it in order to stop Russia cuddling up to NATO, as you put, then I think it's pretty irresponsible.
No, Turkey has the moral high ground. I say again, Turkey was right to do what it did. There's no doubt that if the Russians did do what the Turks say they did, it was premeditated, it was hostile. In an Su-24, you do not make accidents like that. This was a deliberate attempt to cut a corner by cutting over Turkish airspace. Where did the aircraft land? Of course, the Turks and the Russians have quite different versions as to where the crash site is. A fact you'd have thought would be fairly easy to establish, but there's doubt even over that. One interesting detail in this that fascinates me is that the surviving pilot, there was a video of him released by the Turkmen after he crashed. So at some point, he was in Turkmen hands. Now we discover he's back happily at his airbase, released by the Russians and the Syrian special forces. What happened? Was this a snatch or was a political deal done? That's another bit of the story we'll probably never quite get to the bottom of.
Just a final thought on this from you, John, as a former professional diplomat. What would the, from Russia's point of view now, do they see themselves, whether you think Turkey has the moral high ground or not, would Russia see themselves in having a position of some leverage, given that they have lost an aircraft, they've lost at least two service personnel, they are in a position where they can affect a certain measure of anger and indignation, and an angry, indignant Russia is a fairly alarming thing to behold. Is there something that, will they be thinking of how they can leverage this, and if so, how?
Yes, I'm sure that Putin, calculating as ever, we'll be thinking about how to leverage this. Already we've seen expressions of anger. We've seen hostile crowds of young men with very, very short hair throwing nasty things at the Turkish embassy in Moscow. That's probably just a beginning. Actually, what he can do, though, is a lot less clear. He hasn't got that many cards in hand right now.
OK, well, let's move on to somewhere a bit closer to home, to Brussels, which for the last few days has served as sort of a living laboratory of an extraordinary test of that balance between freedom and vigilance. In response to doubtless serious but somewhat vaguely defined threats, the city has been substantially shut down. Schools and most metro stations reopened today, but armed police and soldiers are still patrolling visibly, and the present highest alert level is likely to remain in place until at least Monday. Isabel, I, in situations like this, I start thinking of that old joke about elephant repellent and the chap scattering it in Trafalgar Square. And someone asks him, what are you doing? And he says, I'm scattering elephant repellent. And someone, they say, there's no elephants in Trafalgar Square.
He says, it works.
It's good stuff. is this theatre to an extent? Clearly, the Belgian authorities are spooked by something. But at what point is this... It's hard to know, given we're not sure exactly what they're spooked by, whether this constitutes an overreaction or not.
The old chestnut. This reminds me of is the one about arrest the usual suspects. And I think there's been a lot of arresting the usual suspects. I mean, it has given them an excuse to go do a terrific sweep through, you know, anyone who has ever crossed their path, search their flat, go through their hard drive, look at their mobile phone, and you know, it, as an intelligence gathering exercise. I hope it would be useful. It certainly does not seem to have achieved the desired purpose in identifying and arresting actual suspects. I think one reason that we've seen a huge overreaction is that it would have been politically pretty disastrous if we'd seen an attack, a Paris-style attack.
Belgian media are reporting, and again, it's impossible to know how seriously to take such reports at a time like this, but Belgian media are reporting that something of that sort was apparently planned for Sunday.
Indeed, and had it, of course, been allowed to happen, or had it happened, then you know, no politician, you know, could show his face. And given the amount of criticism that the Belgians had taken from the French, you know, the sort of sense that because of the general dysfunction of the Belgian state, you know, the divided responsibilities and the internal sensitivities, that it was less efficient than it might have been, easy to say from another intelligence service, then I guess they had to have a big display.
The cover of today's Private Eye, I notice, a British satirical magazine for listeners unfamiliar with it, shows the caption is something to the effect of the Royal Air Force to bomb ISIS in its heartland, and there's the caption under two planes of Belgium, here we come. John, do you think it was the Belgian authorities reacting to that fairly explicit suggestion that they've been at worst a soft touch and at best merely incompetent?
I think, yes, there's a lot of that in it. You know, you don't want the finger pointed at you by anybody, least of all the horrible French. But also, if you are told that there is an imminent threat of a terrorist atrocity on your soil at a given time, as you said, you know, they're expecting on Sunday, then you react, you pull all the stops out, and you try to protect your citizens. One of the aspects of this story that sort of leaves me feeling slightly cold is that the police have said that they believe there are at least 10 suspects still at large. So a group quite big enough to pull a spectacular. And yet, Brussels is returning to normal.
Yes.
Effectively, they're saying
odd.
That the danger is still there, but hey, we're going to risk it. It doesn't quite stack up to me.
Because this is the tricky bit, isn't it, Isabel? It's like sending the military in anywhere. And I know it's a quote we've cited before on this programme. I think Harold Wilson, when he sent the British Army to Northern Ireland, said, "I can have them in there in 24 hours. It might take rather longer to get them back out again." And the same is true with a situation like this. At what point, as a government, do you then have to start making decisions based on things like the economic damage that this is doing to your capital and to its citizens? At what point do you decide it's okay to wind it back in? Because obviously the nightmare, if you're a politician, is that you do wind it back in and then something terrible happens.
It's a horrible decision, but you really can't lock down a major European city for more than a few days without you know, losing the sympathy of the population, without massive, as you say, massive economic damage. And Brussels isn't just the capital of Belgium, after all, it is also the capital of Europe. You know, so it is it's a big price to pay. Big price either way, but I think you just can't keep a city locked down like that. And it, or after a while, you know, people begin to say there has to be another way to deal with terrorism. This is not it. This is just handing the victory to ISIS, that, you know, you can scare a major capital city into paralysis. That's a huge plus for ISIS.
It is. I mean, and that was another thought that occurred to me as well, John, that it's impossible to imagine that even if no massive terror attack occurs in Brussels, that Islamic State must be watching proceedings in Brussels with a measure of satisfaction.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that, as Isabel says, that, you know, that will be partly why they've decided to return Brussels to some kind of normality, the metro back and up and running, schools reopening and so on. It gets to the stage where your prevention of a terrorist attack almost looks like the result of a terrorist attack. You know, you come to a standstill.
Just a final thought on this from each of you. I'll ask you first, Isabel. It is far from unlikely, unfortunately, that a similar spectacle that is of a massive security presence might be deployed onto the streets of London at some point in response to some, theoretical or proximate threat. Would the sort of spectacle that you've seen on the news in Brussels, would that make you personally feel more or less safe?
Good question. I think that actually looked at rationally, it is impossible to defend soft targets from such an attack with these means. You know, are you going to shut every supermarket? Are you going to shut? There are just too many places in a city, in cities this size and this sophistication, where people gather. So it wouldn't make me feel more safe, actually. It would make me feel that they had run out of other options and that this option was not going to work for very long.
What do you think, John? I mean, as Isabel says, it is practically impossible to defend everything and everybody in a city the size of Brussels, still more so London. Do you think we have reached the point at which governments have to be a little harsher with, or a little, I guess, brisker with their citizens and saying, look, we can't be everywhere?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think, you know, the point about putting troops on the streets is that while the troops are on the streets, most terrorists will just keep a low profile. But you can't, as we were just saying, you can't get there indefinitely. All you're doing is postponing the attack rather than preventing it.
Or redirecting it. They'll just go somewhere else.
That's right. I mean, deflection, you know, may be your objective. And nasty, but it's, if you're protecting your own citizens, then maybe that's what you're after.
But is there any moral advantage, for instance, in having Sheffield be the object of an attack? If you lock down London, how many other cities are there in Britain which are open?
Yes, I understand what you're saying, but I doubt if Sheffield, to take your example, would be a particularly attractive target terrorist. They would look for another major capital. So you're probably deflecting away from your own citizens. Big difference between London and Paris. Firstly, intelligence and policing, and I say this with, you know, not just because I'm paid to say it, but is a great deal better in London than in Paris. Secondly, you've got CCTV. You don't have it in Paris.
We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Isabel Hilton and John Everard. Coming up next, we'll be looking at the fallout from yesterday's terrorist attack in Tunisia.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Isabel Hilton and John Everard. Now, the two stories we discussed at the top of today's programme have in common that they are reactions at one remove to Islamic State's recent campaign of terror against civilians, which has in recent weeks claimed hundreds of lives in Baghdad, Beirut, Paris and the skies over the Sinai. Yesterday, they struck what might just about be termed a military target with a suicide bombing in Tunis of a busload of soldiers from Tunisia's Presidential Guard. 12 people were killed, excluding the bomber, who has been named by Islamic State as Abu Abdullah al-Tunisi. Isabel, do you get the impression, and it's very hard to say, Islamic State would doubtless claim there is, that there is some central coordinating strategy governing all this, or have we reached a bit like the way that Al-Qaeda became in the early 2000s, a sort of an idea that acquired a momentum of its own with no particular central control?
You mean that the people who were bombing in Tunisia were not under
There's no sinister overlord in a basement somewhere in Raqqa, sort of ordering attacks all over the world.
Well, I think that I've no means of answering that question definitively, but it seems to me that there is a logic to these attacks, which is certainly consonant with some kind of communication. I mean, you know, Tunisia is a relatively successful product. There are very few successful products of the Arab Spring. Tunisia was one of the better ones, and it's just been given a Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, that would be enough for ISIS, I would think, to pick it as a target. They really don't want any kind of success in the region.
It is the third major strike attributed to Islamic State on Tunisia this year. The other two were very much civilian targets and obviously attacks on its tourist trade, the Bardo Museum in Tunis, the beach at Sousse. Is that it, John? Is it just an idea of incrementally undermining the cohesiveness and success, such as it's been, of the Tunisian state?
I think that is the ISIS objective, not just because it's a success, as you correctly point out, but because it's a democracy, which, of course, is anathema to ISIS. You know, Muslims should not work in a democracy. This is all wrong. I don't know whether there is an ISIS mastermind sitting in a bunker in Raqqa directing things, but this was clearly not a random, unplanned attack. I was stunned to learn that the bomber was actually on the bus. How on earth did a jihadi get into that bus? Who was he? What kind of ID was he carrying? There's a whole host of questions that we haven't even started to answer here. ISIS have demonstrated in this latest attack not just that they continue to be a threat in Tunisia, but that they are able to penetrate Tunisian security screens, and that is very worrying.
There's also the subplot here that Tunisia is right next door to Libya, a country which is in a state of more or less complete collapse. Isabel, have we rather taken our eye off that? Given that Syria is more than enough for the world's powerful and etc. to be worrying about, how dangerous is Libya while we're not paying attention to it?
Well, the Tunisian authorities, of course, believe that their previous assailants were trained in Libya. So yes, it is dangerous. It's dangerous as a theatre of operations. It's dangerous as you know, another safe haven for IS. Libya in a state of collapse is a dangerous neighbour, and I think that we may have taken our eye off it, but you know, the places that we haven't taken our eye off are not doing too well either. So it's hard to say that we, if we'd taken more care and paid more attention, it would have been in better shape.
Final thought on this from you, John. Tunisia's government has declared a state of emergency, not dissimilar to the way that the authorities in France and Belgium have in the last few days. Again, is this just something governments do because it's the thing they can do?
No, I think there's more than that. I'm not an expert on Tunisian law, but in general, states of emergency give security forces powers they don't normally have. And clearly, they will want to be able to raid a few homes and ask a few people some quite searching questions in conditions that they might not be able to apply in normal running.
Okay, well, let's look now towards South America and to a hopefully more optimistic story, specifically at Argentina. It's getting used to the idea of not being ruled by a Kirchner. The new president-elect is Mauricio Macri, the former mayor of Buenos Aires, and as such, he's a member of a club of politicians who've made the transition from municipal to national government. He joins, among others, Portugal's new prime minister, António Costa, who was formerly mayor of Lisbon, Italian prime minister Matteo Renzi, once mayor of Florence, Albanian prime minister Edi Rama, previously mayor of Tirana, and in a perhaps less convincing argument, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, who was, of course, once mayor of Istanbul. Isabel, is it a natural progression? Is it basically the same collection of skills you need to run a country as run a city?
Well, I can certainly think of one British politician who'd like us all to say yes to that. I don't think necessarily, no. Running a city, I mean, you would have to say Ken Livingstone would have made a good prime minister if you believe that running a city necessarily equips you for running a country. I'm not sure that would find a great rallying cry. There are talented politicians who come up that way, but you know, causation, it's not causation. It doesn't mean that every mayor can become a national leader. Macri's quite an interesting example. He ran a major capital city. He's already got trouble with the central bank. We'll see. You know, he's made a lot of promises on a collapsing economy. He's going to find them very difficult to fulfill. At the moment, it's still only the Chinese who are prepared to extend credit to Argentina.
John, that example Isabel cites there, obviously, of London's present mayor, Boris Johnson, who clearly fancies himself as a future national leader. But he strikes me as possibly an illustration of the fact that being suited for one office doesn't necessarily make you suited for the other. Because I think mayor of a big city, especially London, it's an arena for a big, gregarious, flamboyant and possibly flawed character. But when you sort of talk about leading a country, is there a gravitas issue?
Yes, you do get gravitas issues, but on the other hand, you can have flamboyant national leaders. We've seen a few around. The other example that Isabel mentioned was China. It's probably worth pointing out that in the Chinese system, it is embedded that you become a mayor and later a provincial governor before you come to top national leadership. So the Chinese at least believe that being a mayor is a training ground for national leadership.
Isabel, is the gravitas thing, and as John mentioned, there have been flamboyant mayors who've become prime ministers. Eddie Rama, for example, the mayor of Tirana, who famously painted the entire city all sorts of various colours, and in my personal experience of him, used to come to work occasionally wearing sort of iridescent tartan disco suits. He has reined it in.
You sound almost jealous.
It's not everybody who could pull one of those off. I certainly wouldn't dare try. But as a national leader, he has become slightly more restrained. Is that necessary?
Well, you know, I was just thinking, as we mentioned the Chinese example, of course, there was a flamboyant politician who indeed was mayor of a very large city. And he's the only one in recent memory who's been taken down in that most spectacular way because he forgot the basic lesson of being in the party. It's like being in the mafia. You should never imagine that you're bigger than the organisation. And that, I think, is probably a general truth about mayors if they're trying to make the transition to national power, that you do have to work with the cabinet. You do have to be more, you have to be better at getting other people to do things for you. As a mayor, you're pretty much dictator in your own little patch. When you're running a country, it's just a wee bit more complicated.
It's a weird thought, isn't it, that to step up that grade, you actually need to acquire a measure of humility. Because the mayor of this country, for example, has the largest personal mandate of any politician in Britain by miles.
Well, that's right. A bit of humility. And also, you need to grow new dimensions. Most mayors don't have to worry too much about defence policy or foreign affairs.
Indeed not. Well, finally tonight, we do need to look at UNESCO's latest initiative, because they're going to grant intangible cultural heritage status to North Korean kimchi. And this is an honour which will recognise Kim Jong-un's favourite condiment as being at least as important as Costa Rican ox herding and Luxembourg's hopping procession of Echternacht. John, North Korea, very much your former beat. You'll have eaten a lot of kimchi.
Yes, I'm a great kimchi fan. Every time I leave Korea, I go through kind of cold turkey through lack of kimchi. You're not going to ask me, do I prefer North or South kimchi?
Oh, I'm absolutely going to. Because South Korean kimchi is already on the list.
It is, yes. A great political statement. You can have the capitalist kimchi on the list. And of course, now we want the non-capitalist kimchi on the list. Simply put, South Korean kimchi is spicy. And I like spicy food, so I tend to prefer South Korean kimchi. But objectively...
You've just done yourself out of a visa there.
Well, trying to get myself back on the visa list. Objectively, North Korean kimchi is better made. And I say that because all North Korean kimchi is made by hand. It's the only way they have of making it. South Korean kimchi tends to be mass-produced in kimchi factories, and the kimchi that you will eat in South Korean restaurants is often just taken out of a tin they just bought at a supermarket.
Isabel, do you have any firm views on kimchi one way or the other?
Clearly, my kimchi knowledge really doesn't stretch far enough. I did wonder whether this was a gesture to please Ban Ki-moon, you know, that the celebration of kimchi was going to be kind of high up on the UN agenda. It's intangible cultural heritage is a pretty wide field. You know, the Tibetan Gesar epic, which is the world's longest epic, it's three times as long as any other epic, is also intangible cultural heritage. So how do you weigh the relative merits of a huge Central Asian epic with a barrel of fermented cabbage? It's really tough.
Yes, or indeed, how do you weigh the barrel of fermented cabbage against the tugging rituals of Cambodia? I mean, my mind starts to boggle at a very early stage, but brave people in UNESCO are facing this sort of manfully and doing it, yes.
We will have to leave it there. John Everard and Isabel Hilton, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. That's all for today's episode, which was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Clara Strunk. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour until 1900, you'll be hearing music from Monocle's international playlist. Daniel Giacopelli follows that with The Entrepreneurs at 2200. I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. I'm also back with this show at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye, and thanks very much for listening.